Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. You never realize how much you rely on something until you don't have it at your fingertips. When I first moved to the U.S. from Germany in my early 20s, my English was pretty good. I could have a conversation and understand most things that people were saying. But the thing I couldn't do was make jokes because I was always missing one little word or another, and that totally throws off your comedic timing. I was trying to craft some funny line in my head, but by the time I finally had it together, the moment had completely passed. And I also couldn't really understand jokes half the time. So people would try to explain to me what was funny, and then I would laugh sort of awkwardly, like, oh, I get it, but I totally did not get it. No clue. And it surprised me how much that affected my ability to feel comfortable around others, to be myself. It seemed like half of my personality was missing. Humor is such an important part of how we connect to others. Sharing a laugh eases tensions or an awkward moment. It lightens the mood when things are going wrong. During this pandemic, we have certainly bonded while laughing over shared misery, like making fun of toilet paper hoarding or Zoom mishaps and mask mumbling. Today's episode is an ode to humor and laughter as a prime coping skill that gets us through tough times.
I think humor, for me, is a kind of a playful use of language or performance of some kind, which has the intention of amusing in a way that might lead to laughter, it might not.
That's Sophie Scott. She's the director of the Institute for Cognitive Neuroscience at University College London. Laughter and humor seem to go together, but Sophie says they are not really in a committed relationship.
I can think of things that I think are very funny that don't actually make me laugh out loud, and I can think of other things that seem really sort of silly and facetious but make me laugh helplessly. So, you know, it's not a guarantee that just because something is funny, there will be laughter.
As a neuroscientist, Sophie has researched the connection between humor and laughter through behavioral studies, across cultures, through brain scans. In one of her studies, she looked at what happens when you add a laugh track, like in a sitcom, to a not very funny joke.
They were deliberately chosen to be bad so that you could make them seem funnier somehow. Adding the laughter makes the joke seem funnier, and the more spontaneous the laughter, the funnier it makes the joke. So that was a very nice result. It's like you can't ignore the laughter. The laughter is part of how you assess the humor of the joke.
When you put people in a scanner, what do you see? Where does the brain light up? Where do we find humor in the brain?
Well, interestingly, and you'll find people who'd viciously disagree with me on this, so you have to frame this as there's always an issue of debate in science. But from my perspective, when there's a very clear network of brain areas that you see recruited when people listen to speech and they try to understand it. And basically, when people hear jokes, that's the network that you get activated. You are seeing the speech perception network because people are trying to understand it. And everything that people say is special about jokes, you know, there's illusion in there, or there's a violation of expectations, or something is reframed. That happens all the time. I mean, think of poetry, think of trying to understand a poem. You never have a piece of language that exists in the world where absolutely everything that is said is being spelt out to the last detail, and where there are no illusions or reframings or misdirections. It's the nature of language that it has this form. The thing that I think is different about jokes is that they are framed in a way that makes it clear that the intention is to be humorous, and that gives you, you know, a kind of a mode for processing it. But I think it is interesting that if people don't know that they're consuming something that's meant to be funny, and they don't have the stuff around them that tells them that it's supposed to be funny. It's not unusual for people not to realize that something's meant to be funny.
Sophie says laughing makes us more relaxed. You can measure the impact.
So you get a reduction in adrenaline very quickly. So adrenaline's the fight or flight neurotransmitter. And when your adrenaline is high, you're ready to go. You know, you're either ready to run away or punch someone. And your body changes quite a lot. And the opposite of all that happens when you laugh. So you are more relaxed. You get, on a longer time scale, a reduction of cortisol. And cortisol is a stress hormone. And so the reduction in cortisol makes you feel less stressed. When you're, you know, if you're feeling a bit stressed all the time, like I have been doing this week, trying to run an institute under COVID, that, you know, your cortisol levels are raised. So that, you know, this would be a way of taking them down. And you also get an immediate bump of, I say bump, like an uptake of the body's naturally circulating endorphins when you laugh.
Now, where does our sense of humor come from? What do we know about that? Is it genetic in some way? Is it learned?
I think it's under quite a lot of influence. You know, your sense of humor is effectively, it's an aesthetic appreciation. The only thing that is definitely true about humor that we've learned from science is that no one thing is funny for everybody over time and place. Never. And no one agrees. This is a... There's never been one thing that everyone on earth has gone, this right now is what we all think is funny. There'll be someone going, no, that's stupid, or no, my brother died that way, or, you know, some other reason to not like it. And that makes it like all other human aesthetic appreciations. We don't all like the same music. We don't all like the same films or the same books, and life would be very boring if we did. So if you think about the things that would shape your musical taste, there's a great deal of role for early experience. There's a massive role for the things that the people around you like. So I definitely have a tremendous fondness for Laurel and Hardy that is almost, not almost entirely, but strongly associated with the fact that my father used to insist from when I was very young, let's sit down and watch Laurel and Hardy together, because he just adored Laurel and Hardy. Because when he was a young man, that's when they were first being famous. So, you know, and I can see that with my son, a couple of things that I find very funny that I enjoyed when I was young, that he now finds funny. So that's part of it. And then, you know, you get older, there's fashions, there's changes, there's sort of who you want to be.
That's Sophie Scott. She is the director of the Institute for Cognitive Neuroscience at University College London. We're talking about humor, what's funny and why. So Sophie was just talking about having influenced her kids' sense of humor. My kids like Monty Python, because I do. But not all that was once funny ages well. Sometimes you cue up a movie or a show that you thought was hilarious a while back, and then you just find yourself cringing the entire time. Why does humor have an expiration date? Jad Slaman looked into that.
When it comes to burning through your Netflix queue as quickly as possible, there's nothing quite like all the bars shutting down as a pandemic wipes your social calendar. My favorite shows are comedies, and I think it was sometime in April when I just plain ran out of new stuff to watch. The thing about comedies is they never really hit the same the second time you watch them. I talked to Anthony Gramuglia about all this. He lives in Jersey, writes about TV, film, and pop culture.
Pretty much a giant nerd, essentially, if you want to sum it up in a nutshell.
He tells me about the role of novelty in comedy and the life cycle of jokes.
It's kind of like in pop culture how for several years following The Matrix, everyone made fun of bullet time.
In bullet time, everything goes super slow motion, and bullets make these little shockwaves as they travel past.
Trinity! Help!
Almost immediately, it became fodder for all these parodies.
You know, you saw it in Scary Movie, you saw it in Kung Pao, Enter the Fist, you saw it in you saw it in Shrek.
Kung Pao probably has the best one. It's a martial arts parody, and the scene in question involves the hero fighting a cow who starts shooting milk at him, all slow-mo style. Anthony brings up this bit because it had a longer shelf life than a lot of jokes, appearing in movies and TV for a good 4 years. Part of the reason is that it was just hard to recreate. The Matrix came out in 1999, so back then it was pretty difficult to pull off in terms of technology. Compare that to the modern meme, where someone comes up with a funny image template on the internet in the morning, and by the same evening, there's probably 40 iterations of it.
It's low effort, easy to create, and everyone does it within short bursts of time. And because of that, you get tired of that joke very quickly, and the internet has become a great means of manufacturing humor with very short lifespans.
The novelty just runs out hyper quickly.
Comics can't do covers in the same way that bands can. Comics can't do their same jokes over and over again.
That's Peter McGraw, a psychologist who runs the Humor Research Lab at the University of Colorado Boulder. He says no self-respecting comedian is going to take the stage and start performing George Carlin's old bits.
And so there's such a premium on novelty and creativity that the jokes of yesterday seem kind of boring because they just seem so familiar. They just seem so hacky. You just have to remember that at the time they weren't. At the time they were cutting edge.
Comedy thrives right at that cutting edge. And Peter says that's part of the reason humor expires so quickly. Older comedies lose their bite over time because what was scandalous and outrageous in one generation becomes quaint one or two later.
That humor arises from things that are wrong yet okay, things that are threatening yet safe, things that don't make sense yet make sense, or what we call benign violations. And a benign violation account of humor is a powerful idea.
Peter says this theory of benign violations, things that are wrong, but not so wrong as to get us to storm out of the room, help explain why jokes can fail in two ways.
That is, it can be boring, it's purely benign, there is no threat, or it can be offensive, it's purely a violation, there's nothing safe about it. So comedians are looking for that sweet spot.
The sweet spot is a moving target, always changing and shifting.
So getting back to the question of why does it seem that comedy has an expiration date? Well, with the passage of time, what's wrong and what's okay changes. And so what might have been a titillating joke in the 70s is now qualifies as a dad joke.
It's almost as if humor has a best buy day, like milk or produce in the supermarket. Maybe a joke has the perfect mix of violation and harmlessness, but the timing is all wrong, like a green avocado not quite ready for breakfast. Peter and his team demonstrated this by following a Twitter account for Superstorm Sandy.
Just blew the roof off an Olive Garden. Free breadsticks for everyone.
Oh my God, Karen, you can't just ask a hurricane why she's only a category one.
This account was tweeting the devastation of the storm in real time as the storm. Peter's team was trying to figure out when these tweets were at their funniest.
What we ended up doing was a test that found comedy is tragedy plus the right amount of time.
Basically, this curve appeared where the jokes were too horrific, too much of a violation, right as the storm was at its worst.
What we found consistent with the too soon thing was that when Hurricane Sandy was hitting New York, power was out, billions of dollars in damage, and so on. People didn't find those jokes very fun.
But a couple weeks later, exposed to the same tweets, people thought they were funny.
They peaked at one point, and then what we found, in this way that we expected, the jokes became less funny.
All in all, the Sandy tweets were funny for like 20 days total. Peter says he thinks that curve of not funny, too soon, to just right, yeah, this is funny, to all right, I'm tired of this, not funny anymore, is probably consistent across a lot of comedy. There's a precious window where the joke is fresh and funny and not too messed up, and then it's gone. But Anthony, the pop culture critic, tells me there's plenty of older humor that still holds up, and it has a lot to do with who or what is the butt of the joke. He tells me about this one scene from Some Like It Hot.
The gist of it is, it's a cross-dressing movie, essentially.
In the scene, a boat captain is completely enamored with a musician who has disguised himself as a woman. The captain has no idea he's speaking to a man in woman's clothing. He proposes, and he won't take no for an answer.
I call Mama. She was so happy she cried. She wants you to have her wedding gown. It's white lace.
Yeah, that's good. I can't get married in your mother's dress. She and I, we are not built the same way.
The cross-dresser starts coming up with all these excuses, tries to get out of the marriage without revealing he's a man.
In the first place, I'm not a natural blonde.
Doesn't matter.
And finally, he's had enough. Just takes off his wig.
I'm a man.
And without missing a beat, the captain's response?
Nobody's perfect.
This movie, which, by the way, came out in 1959, doesn't punch down at the queer subtext, instead celebrating it.
But if you say, make fun of a certain group of people, that ages badly because over time, every demographic of people will get more and more time to share their viewpoint. And the more you understand how a person feels, the less funny it gets.
Movies that punch up at something big like racism or classism, those tend to hold up more than, say, an Adam Sandler movie from the 90s that makes fun of gay people or people with disabilities. And another type of comedy that holds up, Anthony thinks, is the physical slapstick type. And yet again, the critic and the scientist agree. Peter tells me physical comedy has this timeless universality.
That is, that it doesn't rely on cultural norms, it doesn't rely on language, that the violations come from the slapstick in it. And that's really as close as you're going to come to universal.
So if you think you've thoroughly mined your backlog of sitcoms, watched and rewatched The Office to squeeze out whatever precious few laughs remain, maybe you just need to go back a little further. Think classic SNL with Chris Farley ranting about a van down by the river before crashing into a table.
Hey, look at this! I'm gonna throw some eggs around! Look at me go here!
For The Pulse, I'm Jad Slaman.
Why is it funny when Chris Farley crashes into a coffee table or flails around in an ice skating arena in a too tight costume? The explanation could be something philosophers call superiority theory.
And the basic idea is that when we find something humorous, we think of ourselves as being superior to the object that we are considering, the source of the humor.
That's Robert Clewis. He is a professor of philosophy at Gwinnett Mercy University in Pennsylvania.
I think this is why, for example, Aristotle thought of humor as educated insolence. So it's educated, but it's still kind of looking down at the butt of the humor.
Robert got interested in philosophical takes on humor while editing a book about German philosopher Immanuel Kant. And he realized that Kant sprinkled his lectures with jokes.
So I actually collected the jokes. And the original idea was actually to have kind of a joke book. But the problem is, they're not that funny.
Robert says in philosophy, humor is a subcategory of a field of study called aesthetics, which looks at the experience of things like art and also the sublime or awe and humor. And he says philosophers have three main theories of what makes something funny. So the first one is superiority, which we just heard about. And then there is relief or release theory.
You have this tension building up, and then you release it. It was couched in terms of nervous energy, and Freud is probably the most famous defender of that theory.
It's the little joke you make when you first walk into a meeting or when you're about to make a presentation and you feel really nervous about it. The third philosophical idea on humor is incongruity.
Yeah, incongruity is the theory that says that humor is a response to a kind of mismatch or our expectation about the world not being met in some way. It says that when we find something humorous, it's because the world isn't the way we expect it to be.
Like what? Give me an example.
Well, like the concept of dog. So we kind of have in our mind what a dog is, and that includes things like Labradors and so on. It also includes things like the Saint Bernard on the one hand, and then like a Chihuahua on the other. So if all you saw was a St. Bernard's in your life, and all of a sudden you saw a Chihuahua, and someone said, well, that's a dog, you might actually find that kind of funny.
Or I'll give you another more meta example of incongruity. Robert told me that one of the things philosophers might argue over is why humor is so subjective, but they call it
the intersubjective validity of our responses to humor.
What?
Should other people respond to humorous things the same way that we do? Just like in responses to art, should other people find this artwork intriguing or stimulating the way that I do or do not?
And is there some kind of consensus on that or?
There's never consensus in philosophy. That's sort of the nature of the game.
Robert Clewis is a philosophy professor at Gwinnett Mercy University. His new book is Kant's Humorous Writings. This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about humor, what's funny and why. Sometimes a situation strikes us as comical, even though it's not really all that funny. And then suddenly we cannot help but laugh. Neuroscientist Sophie Scott had that experience in a theater during a children's show.
It's very embarrassing. The guy on stage did something that just, I lost it. I was screaming with laughter.
The actor made a joke about Christmas plays at schools where all of the participants have the wrong accents for a biblical setting, like one of the three wise men having an Irish accent.
I've bought myrrh. And there was something about saying the word myrrh in myrrh.
And Sophie just could not stop laughing.
And it really ruined the show for everybody because it was throwing him off his stride. The audience laughter wasn't working the way it should do. And there was one person hooting without pause. And it wasn't good. You would think, well, it's great. Someone's laughing hard. No, it actually spoils things.
And that experience is not fun. Like, I've been there where it's just like you lose control over the laughter. And then at some point, it's really like it feels a little crazy.
You are lost. You are lost in it. There's something very, very intense, and it almost becomes private. If you next time you're laughing really helplessly, you'll know people sort of turn away from the. You couldn't maintain eye contact with somebody while you were in that moment. It's extraordinarily sort of taken away. Even though you're in the room with everybody, you've gone to a very private place of yeah. helplessness.
So laughing at a kid's play like you've just lost your mind is not ideal, but inappropriate laughter strikes in far worse places and situations. Xavier Lopez has more.
I remember being upset on that day. I was hanging out with my friend Fizza Ali at Flushing Meadows Park in Queens, and I wanted to talk to her about something that happened to my cousin, something that was really bothering me. Fizza remembers this day as well.
And then I don't know what brought this up, but you told me that your cousin had a miscarriage, and I like broke out in laughter.
Yeah, she laughed. And she couldn't stop laughing.
Did you think it was funny?
No, I didn't, obviously, but I couldn't believe myself that I laughed that hard. But it just kept laughing, so it was weird.
I was speechless. This was the first time that she had done anything like this, and I just didn't know how to respond to it. But after a few seconds, the absurdity of it all, just watching her, trying to control herself unsuccessfully, it got to me, and I started laughing as well. And it happened again. This time, Fizz and I were hanging out at my place. We were having Chinese food and watching Netflix when my mom came home early, which is not normal. My mom's a home health aide, and she usually stays with her patients till nighttime. She also looked really upset.
She was just like, yeah, my patient died. And I just started laughing. And she looked at me like I was insane. Yeah, I just remember feeling really awkward, and I was like, oh, holy shit. And I guess I felt also awkward because, like, it was your mom. And I don't know if I'd interacted with her before.
They had not. This was the first time that they met. It was very awkward. And I was really embarrassed because I didn't want my mom to think that my friend was this insensitive weirdo. But as I looked over at her, I saw the look of shock turn into a smile and then a laugh. And we all just kind of joined in.
I feel like your mom started laughing too, and you did as well, because I think she looked at me like, wow, this girl is insane. And that kind of lightened the situation, maybe, but...
No, that's 100% what happened. I think that, like, I don't know if she said that you were insane for sure, but I think that...
She definitely implied it in some way or another.
So yeah, that was weird. Especially because I know Fizza. And I know she didn't mean to laugh in both of those instances.
I felt like it wasn't under my control at all, you know? And then I couldn't stop, which made it worse.
We've all experienced some version of this in our lives. Moments when a bout of nervous and totally inappropriate laughter overtakes a situation. But Where does this reaction come from?
We think it has to do with regulating your own emotions.
That's Margaret Clark, a professor of psychology at Yale University. She's done some research on nervous laughter and similar reactions called dimorphous expressions of emotion. Dimorphous meaning taking on two distinct, different forms. Dimorphous expressions happen as a result of really intense situations. When emotions are running high, some people have an excess of energy that comes out in a way that is unexpected.
You're overwhelmed and you express something that's ordinarily associated with a negative emotion, crying when you're happy, and we think it downregulates the intensity of the initial emotion. It works for both positive and negative emotions because you can be overwhelmed with either kind of emotion.
Margaret says things like nervous laughter or happy crying serve to achieve a kind of emotional leveling off. It's kind of like how we sweat when we're warm in order to cool off. For some people, their bodies involuntarily try to regulate happy or sad emotions by expressing an opposite reaction. She says this downregulating has physiological benefits. Cardiovascular reactivity that is high during stressful situations decreases, and people often report to feel better afterwards. And they seem to have social benefits as well.
Dimorphous expressions really can serve this great functional value of coordinating behaviors between people.
That's Oriana Aragon. She's a social psychologist at Clemson University. Oriana says that these expressions can serve as a signal to others.
For example, if somebody just won the lottery and they're crying tears of joy, they're going to get comfort. And it's kind of counterintuitive because they just won the lottery, but that's what it does. It sends a signal of what they need in that moment. And in that moment, when the tears of joy are flowing, they do need that quiet comfort and they do need to stop and pause for a moment.
So the joyful tears say, I'm really happy, I'm overwhelmed, and maybe I need to calm down. Oriana says my friend Fizz's reactions could have been her body's way of reacting to an awkward situation that she subconsciously wanted to lighten up.
So it could have been that your friend was feeling too intense, either discomfort, maybe feeling sad, being worried for you. And her response was to laugh, which seems really unusual. And I have heard this a lot. There are people who report to do this. But it could be that it's serving a really great social function in a way, because you're telling me these situations, and in both cases, that laughter, albeit unexpected and probably even added discomfort to your friend a little bit, because probably she didn't really want to do that at the moment, but it did seem to diffuse what was going on at that moment.
And that's definitely true. Fizz's laughter attached two really upsetting conversations to a somewhat silly memory that we still laugh about to this day. Oriana became interested in these unusual expressions of emotion because of another odd reaction that she noticed while watching TV. It's called cute aggression.
I was up late watching Conan O'Brien, and Leslie Bibb was on.
I have a thing that when if I like somebody, like if people have babies, I'm like, oh, that baby's so cute, I just want to punch it in the face. I was like, your baby, like that dog is so cute, I'm going to kick it in the head. I don't know.
Oriana says in all these cases, what is expressed on the outside does not reflect what is being felt on the inside. And through her work, Oriana found an actual link between these odd or seemingly inappropriate expressions. She says if you're prone to one of them, you're more likely to experience the others. I asked Fizza about that. She says she remembered a few times when she happy cried, maybe once or twice. And for the cute aggression?
Oh yeah, for sure. Doesn't everyone? The other day, my sister sent me a Snapchat of my niece, Miriam, and her cheeks are so huge. And I was just like, oh my God, she's so cute. I just want to slap her. And she was like, slap her? Like, what's wrong with you? And I'm like, not actually slap her, but she just looks so slappable. Like, her face is just asking to be slapped, you know? And she was just like, you're weird.
Oriana says that these expressions are actually pretty common, even across cultures. And that despite what my mom may or may not have thought, they're not usually related to any type of medical condition, even if the situation itself does seem a little insane. So, if a friend of yours says that they want to punch a baby in the face, or if they can't stop laughing when you tell them about some mishap, try to look at the bright side of life, embrace the absurdity, and know that now you have a story you can laugh about for years to come.
Yeah, I remember that. So that was her first impression of me.
For The Pulse, I'm Xavier Lopez.
Yeah, that's bad.
Is it though?
I mean, apparently.
We're talking about humor and what makes us laugh. What's funny to one person is weird or not at all funny to another. Many of us have a friend or a loved one on the autism spectrum. Autism usually affects people's communication or social skills, but it can also complicate connecting through humor. Reporter Juliana Clark has more.
Maya Watkins realized early on that her older brother Zach, who is on the autism spectrum, didn't always perceive humor in the way that she expected.
There was a time where I was pushing him on a swing, and I think at one point I said, oh, I have to stop, my arm's gonna fall off. And a week later, I push him on the swing, and he's like, stop, your arm is gonna fall off. He took it so literally, so it was like a little aha moment.
These moments with Zach helped Maya realize that she wanted to devote her career to helping children and adults on the spectrum. Today, she is a social and emotional learning specialist. Even as adults, Maya and Zach don't always see eye to eye when it comes to humor. Maya loves sarcasm. Zach prefers physical comedy.
For example, my husband is a stand-up comedian and has really, beautful written jokes that are very thought out and make whole rooms full of people laugh. My brother often doesn't laugh at those.
But when Zach watched a video of Maya's husband skateboarding,
actually falling down and actually breaking his arm, and that made my brother laugh harder than anything because it was shocking and it was different and it was like it threw him off and it was physical and it wasn't this intricate sarcastic thing, and it makes me laugh that's the one thing that makes him laugh the most.
When they're laughing together, Maya and Zach feel that shared connection as siblings. But why is it that sarcasm may miss the mark more often than physical comedy? Ali Arena is a speech pathologist and behavior analyst who works with a lot of clients on the spectrum.
So a lot of humor has a sarcastic element, right? Or a little bit of interpretation, like you find it funny because you have all the background information. And sometimes people on the spectrum don't realize that background information was supposed to be there, or they're taking the statement completely literally. Something like, oh, my bad. I had to really explain that to someone because they were like, well, what did you do that was bad?
It's that flexibility in thinking and interpreting words that can be a real challenge for many people on the spectrum. Clinical psychologist Jason McCormick says these are all important mental processes that are used to perceive humor.
Most jokes have, a surprise element to them, but then you also have to sort of have things kind of hang together. So like, as an example, the joke, how did the hipster burn his mouth? And then the answer, of course, is because he ate vegan pizza before it was cool.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So we've all burned our mouths on eating pizza too fast, but the surprise is cool refers to something other than temperature, and it refers more to attitude. But then that second piece is how that all fits together. So you need surprise, and then you need coherence.
But Jason cautions that not everyone on the spectrum struggles with these specific functions.
I don't want to sort of paint this as autism spectrum disorder. There's no way you could ever have a good sense of humor. But aspects of executive function that do make sense of humor kind of more elusive.
Maya and Ali are working together to help children and adults on the spectrum bridge these gaps in humor. They've developed the improv method, where games are used as a form of therapy to treat clients with autism.
Like, I have improv games where the goal is to make people laugh, and you have to learn how to make them laugh, and they try to keep a stone face and not laugh, and it's literally called stone face. And I've played that a lot with people on the spectrum, and they have epiphanies. They're like, oh my gosh, me just repeating a line from my favorite TV show isn't making this person laugh, but that would make me laugh like crazy.
This realization can actually be pretty significant for people on the spectrum. Many of them struggle with theory of mind. It's basically the ability to predict someone else's thoughts and feelings.
So then the children on the spectrum that I work with will do a new idea, and it'll make the person laugh, and they'll be like, whoa, that is huge. That I just went in their perspective and it made more of an effect, and it's super exciting for people on the spectrum.
Humor may seem like a small facet of our lives, but really, it creates opportunities for bonding and shared understanding.
You know, sometimes in improv, like, I will mess up, and I'm like, oh, I can't actually think of a word. And if they, like, giggle at it, it's like, oh, wow, you are also being vulnerable and, like, feeling my uncomfortableness. This is great. Like, we're in this moment together.
That was Juliana Clark reporting. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Coming up, making jokes in troubled times.
I joke about the apocalypse every other day.
We've had a pandemic. We've had fires. We've had an asteroid coming close to the Earth.
Humor as a weapon against adversity. That's next on The Pulse.
Support for The Pulse comes from Select Greater Philadelphia. With over 30 cell and gene therapy development companies, Greater Philadelphia is where the field started and continues to thrive. More at discoverystartshere.com.
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about humor, what makes us laugh and why. Neuroscientist Sophie Scott said earlier that one thing to keep in mind is that humor is very subjective.
No one thing is funny for everybody over time and place. Never.
And humor is also often a way to get people through very difficult situations.
It's used in high-stress professions as a way of managing stress and managing the things that you need to be able to deal with by turning them into jokes.
Think people in medicine, the army, fire department. And Sophie says these jokes can be shocking to those outside of the group.
That's quite deliberate. It's not just, here is a reason for us to laugh together and, you know, feel less stressed about this difficult thing. But it's deliberately keeping others out. It's that bonding. It's you know, we are in on the joke and they are not. We don't want them to get this joke.
For Black Americans, humor has been a coping mechanism to deal with slavery, racism, prejudice, violence. Our next story explores when and how humor succeeds or fails as a way to heal within the Black community. Sam Riddell has more.
Many Black Americans believe that we can laugh at anything. 2020 has been no exception.
I joke about the apocalypse every other day.
We've had a pandemic. We've had fires. We've had an asteroid coming close to the Earth.
If certain people died.
Okay, I think that'd be hysterical. That is me cracking up with some very funny people about some not so funny things. I talked to a bunch of Black folks about humor in our communities, starting with these two.
Ready for Monday night COVID football. Ding, ding, ding.
Pass it. Over here.
That's Rod and Karen Murrow of the Black Guy Who Tips podcast. They're a comedic duo and a married couple whose show's motto is, nothing's wrong if it's funny. Their podcast finds humor in everything from coronavirus to violent crime.
A lot of these things are very sensitive topics, but we just have found a way to take our pain and make it humorous.
Someone being harassed by the police is sad, but if we also decide that the absurdity of racism and the irony is funny, then it is also funny, and our show is a lot of that.
So historically, we've used humor since we arrived here.
That's Corliss Outley. She's a professor at Clemson University and co-author of the 2020 paper, Laughing While Black, Resistance, Coping, and the Use of Humor as a Pandemic Pastime Among Blacks.
As enslaved individuals, humor has been a way to not only connect us, it was a way of hiding things from the master, all in plain sight.
Corliss says enslaved Black folks would embed secret jokes about slave masters and Negro spirituals, use clever sarcasm to avoid doing work, and lovingly trade insults about one another. Rod and Karen's show continues this tradition of Black humor in many ways. One of my favorite, albeit on the surface problematic, segments is
a game we play on a podcast called Guess the Race.
That's right, it's Guess the Race time!
Essentially, the hosts read a news article.
We talk about, like, sometimes horrific crimes.
A man stabs his stepson over unwashed dishes, police say.
And their live chat room audience writes in and guesses the race of the perpetrator.
I say white. Black man with a Newport dangling from his bottom lip. But daddy, do I have to? White.
The segment was inspired by a typical reaction Black folks have when watching reports about crime on the news.
They be describing it and somebody go, I hope they not Black.
This kind of in-joking can serve multiple purposes. Corliss says humor among Black folks is a way to cope and to take back some power.
To control the narratives that were out there about us and to speak our truth.
We're saying we are messy, complicated human beings.
So I do be in my apartment here, like cackling aloud to myself.
That's Janicia Francis. She co-hosts the podcast Tea with Queen and Jay and is a fan of Rod and Karen's show.
Especially in this period of isolation for a lot of people, I enjoy when I hear podcasters laughing together.
Yes.
New York mental health counselor Akua Jenfi says that might be Janicia's mirror neurons at work. Those are neurons that fire when we do an action and when we see someone else do that same action.
I've used this in session with clients and starting just the fake laughter. And just like that, the mirror neurons in your brain firing to mimic what I've just shown you. So I laugh and then you laugh.
Black humor lends itself to additional shared laughter with inside jokes, slang, and common experiences. Here's Corliss.
People all the time don't get it, especially if they're not part of the community. There's a whole genre of researchers that actually look at it as a secret language in terms of linguistics.
Are there instances where humor is harmful and not communal?
Oh, absolutely.
That's Diamond Stiles. She's host of Marsha's Plate podcast and executive director of Black Trans Women's Inc., a nonprofit that addresses concerns facing that community. And sometimes Diamond feels like she's made to be the butt of the joke.
When comedians use like trans folks as punchlines, when they use gay people as punchlines, when they use women as punchlines, mm-hmm. It's almost trivializing these type of really serious situations.
For example, a very popular Netflix comedy special.
I was dreaming when I wrote this. Forgive me if it goes astray.
Dave Chappelle called the LGBT people alphabet people. That was one of the punchlines in his jokes on his comedy show. I didn't hear anybody calling before his stand-up special.
Now, Diamond sees the phrase alphabet people in digital spaces associated with anti-LGBTQ rhetoric.
Dave Chappelle low-key created a slur.
Yeah, like, that's what happened. That's what you did.
But for Diamond, it's not so black and white.
I am a Dave Chappelle fan.
Dum-dum-dum!
So yes, I myself, not in public, make problematic jokes. I think everybody who is a comedian or use comedy as a tool in their work, I think it is your job to actually push our culture forward, not add to the burning flames.
Humor is a tool. It can be used to punch down and inadvertently create slurs. It can be used to punch sideways and embrace inside jokes from the comfort of your favorite podcast. But what does it look like to use humor to punch up? Here's Corliss.
Black people were using humor as a way to confront systems of power and getting individuals, particularly whites, to be discomfortable.
In the tradition of Black humor, I'll leave you on an uncomfortable note. When I hopped on the phone with Diamond, I asked her what's made her laugh most in 2020.
I think all this COVID shit is funny for me because...
Now, Diamond herself has lost 6 loved ones to COVID-19. Yet, she finds irony in how the pandemic has brought folks of privileged identities to see the struggles that marginalized people like trans, Black, and disabled folks face all the time.
How long have disabled people rallied for us to create jobs for them to do at home? I've lost 3 jobs, and it changed the trajectory of my life, and I had to figure it out without any stimulus checks. Because we've been doing this. Get used to it.
That story was reported by Sam Riddell. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about humor. In December of 2002, Joanne McLaughlin's husband, Paul Hathaway, was diagnosed with hepatitis C. It's an infection that attacks the liver, and it often goes undetected for a long time. So Paul's illness came seemingly out of nowhere and got serious very quickly. Back then, treatment options were limited, and his best shot at eliminating the virus was an almost year-long course of treatment with interferon, which can protect cells from virus infection. Joanne says Paul had to get a shot every week.
After about the first 2 shots, he realized that he was effectively non-functional for 24 to 48 hours after he did the shots. Just the following day, he would mostly sleep.
When Paul was awake, he was very dazed. He retreated to his office above the garage, which he called his cave. He was mostly sleeping and not eating.
So I'm thinking, oh, okay, he's not eating anything. This is not good. He's got all this poison meant to kill the virus in his system. He's got to eat something. And plus I'm Italian American. So, you know, I was raised with the, you got to eat, mange. So I figured, okay, I got to do this. I have to figure out a way to make him eat.
Joanne and Paul's relationship was never easy, but they did always bond over humor.
We were a very snarky bunch, kind of very sarcastic and teasing and things like that.
So Joanne figured if she could make Paul laugh, maybe she could make him eat.
At first, I started singing to him.
The brand name of interferon that Paul was getting was Pegasus.
One of the songs I started to sing to him was to the tune of the old Beatles song, Bungalow Bill. And Bungalow Bill became Pegasus Pete. And I would say, hey, Pegasus Pete, you know. I won't sing. I'll spare you all.
Oh, come on. You got to sing a little bit. Okay. How did it go?
Okay. Hey, Pegasus Pete, what did you eat? Pegasus Pete. There you go.
Why was it Pete and not Paul?
I don't know. It just seemed funnier to me, I guess.
Paul did not love the singing, but Joanne was determined. She started packing lunches for Paul the day after his treatment, and to get his attention and to get a laugh out of him, she decorated the lunch bags with cartoons about Pegasus Pete.
Pegasus Pete was the hero of the lunch bags. He was absolutely indomitable. And he noticed it. And I came home that night and he'd eaten something. He'd eaten like half the sandwich. I was like, okay, well, this is a step in the right direction. So I just started drawing cartoons on the bags every week. And my cartoons were primitive, doesn't even begin to describe how bad they were. I am no artist. Stick figures, you know, are pretty much sophisticated for my artwork.
Week after week, Pegasus Pete went on ever more ridiculous adventures.
All the holidays were represented on the lunch bags. He lit a menorah at Hanukkah, sold poinsettias in a garden. Pegasus Pete Christmas. Went dancing. He went to the polls to vote that November. We got a new cat, so Pegasus Pete would have the cat and saying, mind the gap. Pete went everywhere and Pete did everything.
How did you feel? Did it cheer you up at all?
I really think it kept me sane. Yeah, because it was totally distracting. It was a way to take me out of my head worrying about him and not nagging him about, you know, did you eat? Did you eat? Did you eat? Did you eat? It was just my way of saying, hey, this is what I can bring to you. And it made him laugh. It got to the point when he was feeling a little bit better as treatment wore on. He would come in sometime in the evening as I was getting home from work, you know, with a bag in his hand, and he would be like, really? Where did this come from?
Paul got better for a little while, but eventually the virus returned. There were a lot of ups and downs during that period, really hard times. And in 2011, Paul passed away. Still, Joanne remembers a lot of laughter during his last years of life.
We actually had some really good years during that period when he was sick. We were stuck in our little bunker there and we just laughed. It was the way we coped. The illness became the butt of our humor. The prospect of death became the butt of our humor because it was a way of recognizing that it was there and sort of saying, we're not going to let this get us down, even while it was getting us down. He was a strange guy. He was a funny guy. He was charming and a real pain in the neck at the same time. And when I gave his eulogy, I told everybody, and I will say this to my dying day, that he was the love of my life and the bane of my existence, because that's just the way he was. He was like the most contrary human being I've ever met in my life. But he made me laugh.
And he continues to do so.
And he continues to do so, yes. Continues to do so.
Joanne McLachlan is an editor at WHYY. If you go to our website at whyy.org/thepulse, the stories you see there, Joanne has edited them.
One of his famous lines through this whole thing was, what's it gonna do, kill me?
That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, and Jad Slayman. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Xavier Lopez is our associate producer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's health and science reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.